I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. ISIS uses Facebook and Twitter apps and other online tools to recruit new members, to organize attacks and promote their sadistic use of violence. So do other terrorist groups. It's a particularly effective way to spread fear and get attention. We wanted to know more about jihadist groups' use of social media, also what government agencies are doing to try to counter those messages. Interestingly, the hacktivist group Anonymous disrupted a number of Twitter accounts associated with ISIS after the Paris attacks. The messaging app Telegram reportedly banned some channels used by ISIS also after Paris. Joining us are Philip Smythe, a researcher at the University of Maryland, author of the blog Hezbollah Cavalcade, and he's an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Philip Smythe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Kim Zetter, senior staff writer for Wired, wrote a new book called Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. Kim Zetter, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
Nice to have you with us. Phil, let me begin with you. What's so interesting is that these jihadist groups, these terrorist groups, are using what we use. We use Facebook and Twitter and all the online tools that they seem to use as well. Should that surprise us?
Not at all. I think there's a big push in media, and this has been going on since people discovered that, my God, terrorists kind of do the same thing that other normal people might use, the same kinds of mediums. It's not all that shocking. And when you really think about it, strategically speaking, they want to reach broader audiences, and this gives them a very cheap and easy means to do so.
And they do it for the reasons that we do it, which is to be able to communicate with people and to do this out in sunshine, right?
Correct. And, it's even used for recruitment activities. So, when you have setups that are like this, it opens whole new worlds. So this is not like in the 1970s, let's say you wanted to join some radical Marxist group and you had to get in the right click and you had to do this and that and the other thing. Now I can be sitting in my bed and maintain some level of contact with, let's say, a Shia militia recruiter in Iraq. And I've done work like this where I've called up these recruitment lines that I found on Facebook.
Does that explain their so-called success?
Well, in some ways it demonstrates that they're developing along with, many other different things that are out there. It's just another stage of technological development. New technologies are adopted and often co-opted by lots of different elements, even regressive ones that want backwards theocratic systems to be put in place.
Kim, let me turn to you. And I know that Wired received a translated copy of a 34-page guide to operational security. This is, put out by ISIS. What can we learn from this manual?
So the manual was actually written by a Kuwaiti computer security firm for the purpose of instructing journalists and activists in Gaza about how to protect their communications. And ISIS has been using the manual or is suggesting the manual to recruits in order to protect their communications as well. And what they're, recommending that they use are a lot of encryption tools and chat tools that sort of are ephemeral. That is, that once you, after 24 hours or a certain period of time, the chat gets erased, and so it's not kept on a server. So, what this shows is that they are taking a different route than Al-Qaeda took. We know that Al-Qaeda had gone off the grid. They weren't using digital communications. They were using couriers to communicate with one another and to do plotting. And ISIS, on the other hand, is using a lot of digital communications. We know they were using cell phones for texting. We know one of the leaders of the Paris attacks was changing cell phones regularly. So they're using what are called pretty modern operational security methods to avoid tracking.
And would it be fair to say that these are protections that seem pretty typical in many ways in terms of protecting communication?
Yes, I mean, these are the recommendations that groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other civil liberties groups recommend to journalists in covering hot zones and political activists who want to protect their communications from oppressive regimes. So they're making the right recommendations. It appears, however, that they can't control whether or not their recruits actually use them. And we know that in the Paris attacks that they didn't use encryption, at least for some of the final communications. And we know, for example, that even switching cell phones doesn't prevent them from being tracked, because groups like the NSA have really sophisticated abilities to even track when someone changes cell phones.
I mean, Philip, it's been a couple of weeks since the Paris attacks. Have we learned new things about how these terrorist organizations are using social media?
About social media. So while we know, as Philip was saying, that they're using Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts for recruiting, it's unclear exactly to what degree they're using these for operational planning. I think those accounts are primarily to attract new members. And again, this speaks to sort of the age level that they're also recruiting. You're not going to find a lot of probably elderly or middle-aged recruits. They're really going for the generation that is used to social media accounts.
Philip, let me put the same question to you. Have you learned anything new about some of these groups and their use of social media since Paris?
Yes and no. I mean, I think most of what I've learned from them came long before Paris. And I mean, it's just interesting when you look at it and just to kind of go through this again, there's a lot of different groups that have announced themselves using Facebook and using Twitter. And I think this is kind of continued, regardless of Paris attacks or not. In terms of how IS uses it, I haven't seen all that much new information in terms of demonstrating that they're using it for operations, though they do continue to use it, like was stated before, for this kind of recruitment activity and also kind of building smaller radical circles that can propagate their message.
I mean, Philip, if we're talking about the difference between, let's say, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, a generational difference in terms of the use of social media?
Not really. I mean, I to be honest with you, I really think that a lot of these groups, they are understanding that this is the way of the future. And because it's the way of the future, they want to recruit younger people. They want to build a greater presence both in the international sphere and also, even among their followers. They want to kind of create this sort of kind of semblance, if you will, that, this is just kind of the way they're going to go. Of course, I would say that IS is a tad more advanced, and that's putting it lightly, than Al-Qaeda. However, it's not as if Al-Qaeda isn't also trying to use these mediums for their own activities.
And Philip, you mentioned the fact that you have talked to some of these people. This is part of what you do. How easy is it for them either to find you or for you to find them?
Well, I mean, I can discuss specifically Shia militia groups in addition to foreign terrorist organizations that happen to be Shia Islamist in nature. For instance, there's Kitab Hezbollah in Iraq. There's also Lebanese Hezbollah. And both of these organizations maintain very, very, very extensive social media networks. And they've even announced different front groups on them. They have their own YouTube pages. And in terms of finding them, I mean, once you're in their circles, it's relatively easy to figure out what's going on. But it's kind of shocking when you really think about it, about how this has proliferated online. Now, can they find me? I've even had people who are Shia militia accounts that have added me on Facebook and then magically retracted it after, I guess, reading some of what I've written. But I mean, it's happened quite a few times. And it just goes to show how interconnected so many things are.
I mean, they thought you were an ally. Is that why you were getting their Facebook posts?
Well, not always. I mean, I'm a public person that covers these topics. Sometimes people will reach out to me. For instance, there was a secretary general of one group that reached out to a journalist friend in Baghdad, and he said, "Oh, I read Philip's post on jihadology, and I want to correct some of it."
Huh.
And so it was, going to be set up over Skype and over Twitter and over this and over that. And I mean, it's not really the first time that something like that's happened. But I mean, it's just one of many numerous anecdotes. And how many people would really be able to pull that off from, you know, an office in D.C. just a few years ago?
Kim, are we talking about a digital warfare?
Excuse me?
This is to Kim. Yeah, Kim, go ahead.
I'm not sure of the question.
I mean, for instance, there's talk about putting boots on the ground, you know, that we need to, if we want to so-called fight ISIS, that we have to put boots on the ground and we have to increase our drone strikes and do things on that battlefield. Should we think of this as a different kind of battlefield?
I don't think we're talking about digital warfare. I mean, digital warfare is very specific. It would be attacking critical infrastructure of a nation, if ISIS starts targeting that in us, you know, attacking our critical infrastructure, then, you know, that's a certain type of digital warfare. That would be, sort of asymmetric, that they don't have critical infrastructure that we can go after. So I think that we haven't seen that yet. We have seen some talk about them going after critical infrastructure in the U.S., but there's no evidence that they've actually taken steps for that. In terms of the U.S., using methods to go after them, yes, I mean, drone strikes obviously are going to be a tactic, and we've seen that they've used that already against operatives.
I mean, Philip, do you see this as sort of, as you look into the future, that this will be waged more online than on the battlefield?
Oh, I doubt that. Look, if you're fighting a war, it means people are going to get killed. The internet and different systems that are coming off of it are just parts of that. I mean, of course, there might be cyber attacks. There might be this. There might be that. But to say that it's going to shift, kind of like a paradigm shift, I have serious doubts of that.
How do you suggest, and I'll put this back to you, Philip, but how do you suggest, and perhaps the government is doing it, perhaps not doing it particularly well, that this country then engage and try to turn people away from groups like ISIS?
Well, it's an interesting way to go about this. I mean, I have a number of very close friends who work in the CVE field, the countering violent extremism field, and there have been some advances that have been made there. But again, it's all kind of a gray area. I mean, even finding people psychologists who are analyzing, well, what makes a person into a terrorist and what radicalizes them? You have a million different theories on the ground with that one. So it's a very, very tough endeavor. Does it come down to counter propaganda? Does it come down to taking down certain sites? I think sometimes yes. I mean, it's still that gray zone.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Philip Smyth, he's a researcher at the University of Maryland, author of the blog Hezbollah Cavalcade, and he's also an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Also with us is Kim Zetter, senior staff writer for Wired, wrote a new book called Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about how jihadist groups, groups like ISIS, are using social media. And again, talking with Philip Smyth and Kim Zetter. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Philip, let me read an email for Bernie who says, Marty claimed in our intro today that the hacker group Anonymous disrupted many Twitter accounts of ISIS. This is false. Anonymous simply identified lots of alleged Twitter accounts to Twitter. And Twitter disabled those accounts without even verifying that they were all ISIS accounts. Please use a correction and get your facts straight. That's aimed at me. Can you get my facts straight, Philip?
Sure. I mean, I have a lot of bones to pick with the whole Anonymous story. But first and foremost, yes, a lot of these accounts were reported to Twitter, and due to their terms of service, some of them were taken down. In terms of some of them not being ISIS, Well, I can actually I have a great personal bit about this. And I'll tell you something. Anonymous, because you're talking about an anarchic vigilante style group. They went after the page that hosts my blog that I do on Shia militias called jihadology.net, which is run by probably one of the leading experts on ISIS, Aaron Zellin. They actually did a number of DDoS attacks against that page. A few years back, they even attacked Will McCants, who's another ISIS expert who's over at Brookings. They attacked his page, which is Jihadica. I have a lot of problems with a lot of the stuff coming out where people, you know, they think, oh, it's got kind of this sexy name thing. Oh, Anonymous is doing this. And, you know, we really need to cover it. And look, they're really bringing it to the Islamic State. I just look at it and it's amateurish at best. And when you have people who aren't even literate enough to look at the pages they're attacking simply because it says jihad in it, we have a little bit of a problem.
Do you want to weigh in on this at all, Kim?
No, I agree with him. I think that it's the Anonymous group itself is not very organized. It's just a collective of people who sort of join in on the same activity, and they're not really vetting the social media accounts that they're going after.
Let me ask a couple of things just to make sure our listeners understand. And Philip, if I can go back to you, and Kim, I'll get you back in on the conversation. There's an app called Telegram. What should we know about that, Philip?
Well, Telegram is an interesting kind of an encrypted app. You can put it on your phone or on your computer. And I will say this, a variety of different militant and terrorist groups do use it as a means to push out different data forms. I've seen it for, you know, different religious stuff, sometimes different announcements from Kitab Hezbollah. They'll have their own groups on there. But it's an encrypted app that a number of different organizations have used to communicate and you know, push their line.
Now, I also said in my introduction that Telegram reportedly has banned some channels used by ISIS. Am I correct on that, Philip, or not?
Yes, it did take them a little bit. And actually, the reasons behind that, their founder said that the Russian government put pressure on him. I mean, I always find that very, very interesting whenever the Russians are involved with this. Just kind of on a side note, and I hope this isn't too much of an aside. A lot of IS accounts actually moved over to VK, which is a Russian-administered social media site. And you kind of know what that means. Guess who's monitoring that one? But for some reason, they like to move to that page as well. So it's interesting to kind of see that interplay.
Well, and VK, as I was reading, Philip, described as the Russian version of Facebook. Is that correct, or is a sort of an approximation of Facebook?
It is. I mean, it's essentially a kind of, I don't want to say a mirror, but it's their version of it.
Kim, let's talk about encryption. And I guess, sort of broadly speaking, what should we know about encryption?
Well, encryption is designed to prevent the interception of communications. So it can prevent, you know, the NSA and other intelligence groups from intercepting communications between servers as you're talking to someone else. What it can't do is protect communications if your computer is already compromised. So, for instance, if authorities have targeted an operative, know his computer and can infect it with malware, they can get at what that person is typing before it gets encrypted, before it gets sent, and can also get at the communication after the person has decrypted it on their computer. So encryption isn't a cure-all to protect communication, but it is certainly one effective method.
I'm looking at a piece you wrote after Paris attacks. Here's what the CIA director gets wrong about encryption. The first thing you say is backdoors won't combat home-brewed encryption. Explain what you mean there.
Right. Well, the government has been very vocal. The U.S. government has been very vocal about wanting software companies and encryption makers to put backdoors into their systems so that, for instance, if a phone is seized, iPhone is seized, a company like Apple would be able to unlock it for authorities, and also so that authorities could unlock encrypted communications that they're intercepted. The problem with that is the attackers will simply switch to encryption methods that aren't produced by American companies. You can force an American company to put a backdoor, but they will just switch to other programs that aren't governed by that. Or they'll make their own encryption apps, and then that won't have a backdoor in it either. So the problem with that is that it puts all of us, makes all of us less secure, because if you have a backdoor in an encrypted system for U.S. authorities, it means that other authorities can also use that backdoor.
And use it with our devices, right?
Yes, and regular hackers as well. I mean, any backdoor makes the system vulnerable to any attacker, not just the U.S. government.
Philip, you want to weigh in on that at all?
Oh, no. Well, I agree with many of the points. Though what I will say is I've kind of come around, even though I'm a little bit more libertarian on a lot of things, I've come around to some of these backdoors, particularly when I've watched different terrorist groups move over to a lot of different other mediums. For instance, I brought up VK earlier,
which is
Russian. I always like to have some system in place that means that, you know, we can get at the bad guys, in some way. I do worry about hackers getting in. I worry about, you know, there are other governments that can get into a lot of these different pages. But I don't know. I'm kind of in that iffy gray zone where I'm saying, well, there's benefits to it. There's also things that I don't really like about it. But we live in a crazy world. What could I say?
Well, and I think, Kim, if I can toss that back to you, I mean, I think a lot of us probably share some of what Philip said there, which is obviously we want protection from people that want to do us harm and at the same time want to protect our civil liberties and our sense of privacy.
Yeah, but you know what? The White House itself has come to the conclusion that the trade-off is not worth it. The White House, the National Security Council, which is advising Obama on this issue, put together a report examining whether or not backdoors and encryption keys in the hands of the government were worth the trouble of what that will cost us in civil liberties, and they decided that it wasn't. Mm. So they know that there are other methods for government to get after communications like this. And I want to point out again that, you know, to do encryption right, you have to do it perfectly. There are a lot of things that you have to get right. We've noticed that ISIS didn't do encryption right on everything. We know that, for instance, the phone that was seized from the Paris attacks, which was instructing the timing of when they were moving on their attack, wasn't encrypted. We know that the ISIS attacker, like I said, one of the planners was switching phones, but authorities knew that he was switching phones. There are a lot of different methods that authorities can use to track people and get at their communications without undermining the security that all of us benefit from.
And Philip, I did have a question about, you know, from what we know about the Paris attacks and ISIS, whether there was a certain carelessness on the part of the terrorists or even a kind of ignorance about how social media is supposed to work.
I think there's a lot of ignorance in terrorist circles in terms of how different social media applications and also different encryption applications work. And you know what? I'm perfectly fine with that.
Hmm.
So, I mean, the less they know, the easier it is to, well, take care of them. But in terms of the Paris attacks, I mean, if we're looking at attacks that have occurred, let's say in Iraq, where people were using, you know, 57 different Nokia phones, you know, the little phones that you can throw away. I mean, people are always looking for a little bit of an edge. They look for what they know often, and things like this happen. There's no such thing as a perfect attack where there's no problems here or there or anywhere else. So it's not that shocking that they wouldn't use one phone with encryption and that, you know, certain government agencies weren't already, you know, tracking them on some medium.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Philip Smyth, researcher at the University of Maryland, author of the blog Hezbollah Cavalcade. He's an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Kim Zetter, also with us, senior staff writer for Wired, author of a new book called Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. And we are talking about how terrorist organizations, jihadist groups are using social media, just the way we do, Facebook, Twitter, and other forms of social media. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Philip, let me go back to you. How much out there you think are fake sites or misinformation sites or people that are posing as terrorists and trying to, you know, act tough on the internet?
there are a few people out there like that, and a few nut jobs, and yeah, I'll call them nut jobs. I mean, who else would really be doing that? There are a few people like that. What I'm more concerned with is the misinformation and the info ops that are actually put out by the organizations themselves, and the data that's pushed out. And I can give a few different little for instances here.
Sure, go ahead.
In terms of Shia militias, because I like to analyze them, Kitab Hezbollah has used social media in a way to really make the United States look impotent. They actually were putting their flags, their logos, all sorts of stuff on M1A1 Abrams tanks, which are relatively advanced tanks that we sold to the Iraqi government. Now, what does that mean in terms of how are we going to supply our allies in the Iraqi government, in the Iraqi army, if we now see that a registered terrorist group that calls us the Great Satan and has killed hundreds of Americans is now using their equipment? And also, how do people, like in my position, when I see this stuff, I'll put it up on Twitter. What exactly is that doing for the broader messaging and for, you know, broader policy goals? What does that mean? You're now going to have people push back and say, maybe we shouldn't send anything to Iraq. What's the end result of that? Well, Iran can step in and say, look, Iraq, the Americans really hate you. You should rely on us more. I worry about different operations like that that are being cast through social media, because now it's not simply being directed at the government. It's now being directed at a larger population that will often disseminate the message unknowingly. Like they won't even know that this might just be just some agitprop to confuse people or to create further problems.
How does the government, using your example, though, how does the government then counter that image, that message using social media, or can they?
I think it's highly problematic, but again, it's all about being proactive. And I really haven't seen any real responses to that, to photographs like that or anything else. I think if we were really being proactive, we would do counter IO campaigns where we would kind of demonstrate how these groups are, one, liars, two, not all that powerful, and three, maybe they're not in control of all that much American equipment. And let's say if they are, then we can use the data at hand to actually counter them in some way. I mean, but then again, you need the interest from the policy circles and from the administration to actually be able to do that in this instance. But I mean, you get the drift in terms of how one can counter it.
Well, I get the drift, but why aren't we doing it?
way above my pay grade.
Kim, you want to weigh in on this at all?
No, that's okay.
All right. Fair. I'm just trying to be equal time here. Let me get to, it looks like David from Central New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. You know, in service of the emotional well-being of our people, I believe our government could do a better job defining the threat we face. And the example I'll use is post Pearl Harbor, FDR told everybody to go out and buy a map for his next fireside chat. And he actually walked them through the points on the map, and the whole country was just gripped with fear. I mean, we hear all the time, don't be afraid, see something, say something, now text something. See something, text something, but I don't think it's defined clearly in a way, and I don't think the government leadership is calming us down enough to be supportive and rational.
I mean, David, it sounds like you were saying, though, two things. You were saying be afraid, but calm down.
I think our government keeps saying, the worst thing that can happen is that we will be afraid, but I don't see any concrete steps taken to make us not afraid. All I hear is that every time I see a bag in Port Authority, I'm supposed to run and find somebody with a badge.
Right. What would you like to do, though?
I would like our leadership to clearly define on a map for all of us exactly where the locus is at any given time. And what are the legitimate types of things that we need to fear, and what are the bogus things that are just there but will never really materialize? And I don't think that's happening.
Well, let me see what Philip Smythe has to say. Philip, your thoughts.
There's a great Yiddish proverb, from your lips to God's ears. we're wanting all this stuff. I mean, there are a lot of people who are in the intelligence community and who are actively countering this stuff. But in terms of what the government lets out, I mean, we run into a whole different slurry of other problems. The way you're putting this out is, where's the problem? Well, have we concluded what the real problem is, and also how much does the American public need to know of this problem, and this problem? Trust me, it's more than just the quote-unquote Islamic State. There is a far, I mean, there are far broader threats that are out there. I mean, I think we all remember that. You know, remember the little colored chart that was put out during the Bush administration?
Yes.
Not many people paid attention to that. So.
And that was the colored chart, sort of depending on what the government says was the sort of the threat level at the time.
Correct. I mean, you run into this problem where, you know, do you keep everybody on edge? Well, how, you know, do you want to keep everybody on edge? I think that would have many, many detrimental effects just on our economy and on just society as a whole. I can only imagine talking to my mother, given what I do, if this were the mindset that were already in place. But I mean, I do understand what the caller is getting at, where things at times appear very vague, and, you know, how do you want to be helpful for, you know, a variety of different situations? And I wish I had a really good answer, but, you know, we're once again in that gray zone of,
Well, and I'm thinking even of Paris, where it was true here after September 11th. But in Paris, people were saying, you know, be Parisian, go out to and have your wine and your crepes and live as if the terrorists are not going to take away your way of life. I mean, Philip, that seems to be a very strong message that people seem to at least understand in Paris.
Well, of course. I mean, but then again, we heard the same messages after 9/11, too.
Right.
You know, we're just, this is just the way it is. They tax, shock people, and this is the purpose of terrorism. You know, put people in shock and control their behavior. And of course, you have governments that are out there that don't want people sitting inside all the time and, you know, out of fear.
And that's Philip Smyth, researcher at the University of Maryland, also an adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's got a blog called Hezbollah Cavalcade, also with us, Kim Zetter. And she's the author of a new book called Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. She's also senior staff writer for Wired, and we are talking about how jihadist groups, how terrorist groups are using Facebook and Twitter and other online media. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Kim Zetter and Philip Smyth about how terrorists are using Facebook and Twitter and other online activities to recruit followers, to organize actions, even attacks. Also, how government agencies, the government itself, monitoring some of this activity, and in many cases, wanting more authority to track some of this activity online. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Kim, I'm thinking about all the tracking that the government does, not just of these terrorist organizations, but as we have learned, of U.S. citizens as well. Are they just drowning in data?
Yeah, you know, something that we see after almost every attack is missed communications or missed tracking. We see this with the Paris attacks as well, where authorities had some of the attackers, some of the operators on their radar. They were on watch lists. They knew that they had traveled to Syria for training, things like that. And I think the problem here is that there are just too many people to be watching. Paris, in France, authorities there had about 11,000 people on a watch list. So, you know, you're trying to track thousands and thousands of people that you think might be involved in some kind of an attack. And you never know exactly who's the person that's most likely to conduct an attack. And so what often happens is they're focused on the wrong person or they're focused on the right person, but at the wrong time. I think it's really difficult to get this right.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to predict what people are going to do, including people that seem to have terrorist impulses, Kim.
Yeah. And you have to be tracking their communications consistently over time. You know, if someone was recruited by ISIS and had trained, you know, 2 years ago, you know, at what point do they actually become a real threat, or at some point do they give up their training and abandon that lifestyle? You know, it's just a lot of factors that you don't really know are going to happen, and a lot of people that you don't really know when they're going to turn into the threat that you need to watch.
Do you think it's a matter of trying to have better criteria, if I can put it that way, to try to figure out who is an imminent threat, let's say, or a true potential terrorist threat, and sort of winning and getting rid of others that are borderline? Would that be helpful, do you think, Kim?
Yeah, but the problem is that a lot of this is decentralized. So you might have cells in local areas who are doing their own planning, who aren't communicating with any kind of central body.
Right.
So, you know, it's one thing when you're tracking a group that is centrally controlled, and then you can see the communications that are going down to the operatives. When you have localized cells that can be popping up anywhere, and with a leader that can pop up anywhere, it's much more difficult to pinpoint where you need to be watching and who's going to be of most concern.
And, Philip, you want to weigh in on that? I mean, the idea of sort of figuring out how to tracking some of these more well-known groups, but as Kim was saying, that others that are evolving and popping up here and there.
I think it's extremely hard if you're trying to get these the so-called lone wolves of people who are influenced by propaganda, and then all of a sudden they pick up a hatchet one day and decide they want to plunge it into the skull of a New York City police officer. I mean, that those are very, 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 very hard, and I cannot say that enough. I mean, in terms of tracking different groups, different people that may be in the United States that may be operating here, sure. I mean, it's a good idea. I just think the problem is when you look at how certain organizations are trying to not simply recruit but just get attacks going. I think a good example of this was the Fort Hood shooting. Look, there was communication between Alecki's people and the shooter, and this was a radicalization process that was on a very one-on-one level. This is the kind of thing that IS does quite a bit, and it is somewhat hard to really find out, you know, which circles they're doing this in. It's not as if there's a Twitter account that just says Islamic State, hey, here are the people we want to recruit, click this button. It doesn't work that way. I mean, there's a lot of things are hidden and masked, and sometimes it's just in plain sight, and it's very, very hard to see and very, very hard to track. And I really do say this, in terms of being proactive, you need people who are, you know, kind of on the ground doing this stuff all the time. I mean, there was a time when I was first starting this kind of work in terms of analyzing different organizations that were coming up, and I was getting, you know, maybe 3 hours of sleep a night. It was not very good for relationships, but hey, you know, it was good for the job. But you need that kind of thing, that kind of focus on different organizations and kind of different movements that are going on there to get not just the view from 30,000 feet, but to also burrow in and see exactly what's going on.
And when you say on the ground, you mean really, really sitting in front of your computer, right?
Essentially. I mean, in that case, yes. But also, I mean, you do also need people actually on the ground who are dealing with these groups and seeing how they're behaving in their different areas that they are controlling.
An email from Phyllis, who's speaking to something that I was just thinking about. Phyllis saying, how about domestic terrorists using the internet and digital means to communicate and to learn terrorist techniques? These guys are currently the more immediate threat in the U.S., such as the shooter at the Planned Parenthood Center in Colorado on Friday. Although from what I've learned about him, he seems like very much a lone wolf in this situation. But can I toss that back to you, Phyllis?
I'm sorry, can you just repeat part of that?
Well, I guess the question is, I mean, we've been focusing on ISIS and what's been happening in Paris and other parts of the world, but we have a problem here in this country, it seems. You talked about the Fort Hood shooter, where we've got people carrying out terrorist attacks in this country.
Well, sure. I mean, I think with this shooting, we need a little bit more data, just like we need more data if there's, you know, a so-called, you know, jihadist attack or something. And by the way, I'm sitting in Denver right now, so this has been on the airwaves quite a bit.
Sure.
But I mean, what I will say is, I mean, I think that a lot of people can be affected by many different messages. Luckily, in this country, we have the First Amendment, and then we can even find IS stuff. It's kind of hard to crack down on certain radicalizing factors. So I think it's really hard to address things like this, you know, particularly with domestic terrorism. I do think that our authorities do have a good handle on it and how to deal with them. Might there be a rise because there is, you know, increased social media traffic? Sure, that I'm not saying there won't be, but again, I mean, we're running into tough tough times in terms of tracking down lone wolves or people who just want to go off on and do their own thing. Or even with that, I mean, if we're talking about people with mental problems, I mean, how does one really counter that one?
Sure. Sure. Well, and Kim, I mean, picking up on something you said earlier, but also what Philip was just talking about, obviously in the United States, we've got free speech laws. People are allowed to say outrageous things. There's a line which you're not supposed to cross, but sometimes that feels like a kind of wavy line. Can you weigh in on that?
Well, I think that, you know, we've decided as a society that there are things that we want to weigh, and we want to weigh, you know, national security issues against civil liberties. And finding that balance isn't perfect. You know, once we have a tragedy, we want to weigh on the side of national security. We want more surveillance and things like that. But I think that in the long term, that doesn't make for a stable society. And I think that we need to maintain that balance so that civil liberties are protected. We have a long tradition in this country of First Amendment rights, and I don't think that we want to give that up just for the sake of security.
I was reading some people blaming Edward Snowden, you know, for various attacks and things like that. Kim, what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, so I don't really understand that line of argument. You know, we had Al Qaeda, we've had terrorist attacks long before Edward Snowden. We've had the terrorist community being aware of encryption and surveillance long before Edward Snowden leaked. So I don't really see the connection.
I'm wondering too, Philip, then we'll get back to our callers, a couple of comments as well, whether there's a fear or danger of driving some of these groups into the dark web where they might be harder to track, that there's something using Facebook and other forms of social media at least allows the government and perhaps us to be able to monitor what they're saying and doing.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, there are pluses and minuses to having them out there. Going back to my personal experience, when I started discovering all of these new groups, it was hilarious. One time, here I was sitting in my office, and I had a meeting with kind of the people from State Department and whatnot. And they went, "We had never even heard of these groups, mind you. You know, they've got trillions of dollars behind them, and probably should know about them." So, I mean, I think there is a benefit to keeping it on there. Then again, if they are talking about operations, if they are talking about really, you know, doing hands-on things, they're going to go into a quote-unquote, you know, darker web. And I don't really like to use that term anyway, but I mean, they do their best to obscure and hide other activities that they are engaged in. But I do like keeping them out there so long as they are not, you know, so long as it's not direct recruitment. I have a huge problem where there's a lot of direct recruitment going on Facebook, and I see it pretty much every day. If I were sitting in your studio, I could pull up the computer and find you a Kitab Hezbollah recruitment Facebook page in about 5 minutes, and I could call it from Skype. I mean, I think that the U.S. should probably be doing more to take things off like that. It does have, you know, residual benefits in a lot of different policy spheres. But then again, do we really want to take all of that off? Do we really want to take it off when, you know, we can actually see hands-on, oh, well, if they're putting up recruitment material, and I actually did this in terms of charting the recent offensives that are going on in Syria that are Iranian-backed. I could see that there was going to be a major offensive because of all this recruitment material that was going up. It was considered hard data, and when I brought it to the think tank and when I brought it to a lot of different academics, they were all saying, well, finally, you know, we actually have hardcore evidence, not just, you know, some flight manifestos of vague stuff, you know, going into Damascus. This is actually hard, and you can see this, and I could call up those numbers. I could talk to those people on Facebook and say, oh, hey, I want to join the, you know, the sacred defense of Sayyida Zainab in Syria. You know, why are we doing it now? And I'd actually get an answer at times. So, you know, it's I mean, there are benefits to keeping it on there.
I remember an article in The New York Times a couple of months ago about the recruiting of a woman. I think she was in Washington State or one of the Western states. And the time that it took for I believe it was ISIS to the time that they spent with her. I mean, it went on for months, and this was one lone recruit. I mean, it didn't work out in the end, but nonetheless, just the time that they're willing to spend to get someone over onto their side, Philip.
Well, I mean, I think that's IS. IS Everybody talks about how highly efficient they are online, and they have slick videos. I mean, I love hearing that phrase.
Are they slick videos?
What was that?
Are they actually slick videos?
At times they are, but come on. I mean, a lot of different groups make quote unquote slick videos, you know, but they get a lot of attention because they are, you know, in the centerpiece of analysis in terms of terrorist groups. Not saying they shouldn't be in many cases, but, you know, I think a lot of times this is pushed and kind of made, and I'll say this again, it's sexy name factor. Oh, you know, ISIS has this video. But again, to go back to your question, their recruitment process, the way they do it, it comes down to, there's a lot of man hours that are required to vet people, to make sure they're okay, then to get them over into the conflict zone, to make sure that they can actually stay in the conflict zone. That takes a lot of time and effort. Some of the groups that I analyze that are Iranian-backed, they've gotten this down to a science. Hmm. They have centralized recruitment phone banks. They will ask for your information, you know, everything, you know, going right on down, your birth date, you know, yada, yada, yada. You know, they will also double check, oh, is he really in Basra? Okay, we're going to check the address that he gave, and then we're going to interview a few people out there. I think that they are much more highly efficient. But when you look at IS, again, a lot of this comes down to their other process of radicalization. And if you're trying to radicalize somebody by isolating them and giving them your propaganda points and continuing to filter it through their heads, and then also having the same person who's acting as the recruiter, that's kind of the big benefit. That's the big sell. I think that's – is it effective in some ways? Yes, but it's time-consuming. And how many people are you going to have in the Islamic State who are sitting around the computer cafe day in, day out, talking to somebody and really trying to get them to do this? I mean, it does take a lot of time and effort.
Let me get to Bill on. Bill from Philadelphia. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to raise a point apropos of what your speakers said about the Islamic State using American military equipment and putting their flag on it and using it against us. It would strike me, anyway, that with today's technology, our military should be able to have remote trackers in all of our military equipment and either use that to track the movements of the Islamic State, which apparently we have some trouble doing on the ground, or actually to booby trap something like a tank and blow it up while they're using it. It would seem like a pretty straightforward thing to do in today's day and age.
Well, Bill, Kim, I don't know whether you feel comfortable responding to that or not. I just want to make sure that you get some equal time here. I mean, and if we're talking about, I guess, technology, are there technological fixes here that the U.S. could consider using?
I think I'll pass that to Philip.
Okay. And Philip, we have about 30 seconds.
All right. Well, not to be a super pedant, but I was actually talking about Kitab Hezbollah, which is a Shia militia group, which is also a terrorist group, which is fighting IS. I think there's this notion in media where, you know, oh, we can just put in a kill switch and it magically dies. It doesn't always work that way. If you have, you know, explosives sitting in your M1 Abrams tank that you just sold to the Iraqis, they're bound to find the thing, and it's bound to not work that way. Would I love more tracking type of devices in there? Yeah, that would be great. But again, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if maybe there was stuff in there that was like that. I mean, anything's possible.
Well, on that note, Philip Smyth, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you, Philip.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Researcher at the University of Maryland. Kim Zitter, thank you very much as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
Senior staff writer for Wired, author of a new book called Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet and the Launch of the World's First Digital Weapon. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download podcasts of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.